Rolling.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, thank you so much for joining us. I'm guessing this is from your office in Ramallah?
Yes, that's right.
Welcome to our show. This is Unapologetic, and today we're speaking to Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Dr. Mustafa, you were born in Palestine back in 1954. It's been a long time, but the occupation has lasted even longer. You were 13 years old when the 1967 war happened. What do you remember about life before that, before the war?
Well, that was a life of a normal childhood, actually. Of course, we always felt the Palestinian problem because of the refugee camps that were everywhere, and including in Ramallah, where my family lived at that time. And my family was quite alert politically and politically active. Many of my family members were arrested several times because they were in opposition. And they were working very hard to find a way for freedom of Palestine.
What was the political movement like back then, compared to now, or even compared to years after that?
It was all underground, basically, because the political parties were not allowed to function in the West Bank, which was under Jordanian rule at that time. And so there was no freedom of political organization. And many of my cousins and relatives were put in jail for 8 years because they've been politically active in different parties.
And this all happened when you were a child. So it was quite regular when you were a young boy of 8, 9, 10 years old to have cousins.
Yeah, I remember, you know, some of the people I became acquainted with, politically active people, told me a story that when I was 2.5 years old, my father went to visit my cousins and my uncles in prisons. And he took me with him when I was a child. When he got to the prison, somehow they sneaked me into the place where these prisoners were. And so this was my childhood, the first visit to a prison when I was 2.5 years old. And that's not only my story. I think it's the story of many Palestinian families.
And then how specifically did the actual 1964-67 war change things? How did that, it sounds like it was just a continuation of what was already a very...
Did it change
significantly?
Not for me. 1967 was a turning point in my life up till now.
Tell us more.
I was only 13 years old. We were very much believing at that time that the Arab countries will come in and liberate Palestine and solve the issue of the Palestinian refugees. And of course, everybody was relying on what the Egyptian army will do and some other Arab armies. There was this sense that if the war breaks out, this will bring us close to Palestinian, free Palestine. 1967 was the shock of my life, and it changed my life in three ways. First of all, my childhood ended on that day. That's for sure. I felt like the whole world fell on my shoulders. Like I now have a responsibility, and that others have failed us. And it created in myself, in my brain at that time, I think, a very strong sense that we should be self-reliant and we should depend on ourselves and not depend on anybody else. And I don't think it was exclusive for me. I think our whole generation got that feeling. But also on that day, when the war broke out, I was a volunteer with the scouts. And they called on people in the scouts to come and help with the first for injured people, because people were being injured. And I don't know how my family, it seems that I was strong-minded, and so my family let me go, although the war was going on, you know. And I went and I was mobilized in first aid teams. We got training for 2 hours by a medical doctor. And then we were out in the field trying to help the injured people. Ramallah was bombarded by airstrikes, by Israeli airstrikes, and also by artillery. And I started to see death for the first time in my life. I saw people who were killed because of this bombardment. We helped many injured people. So probably this also changed my life in the sense of wanting to become a medical doctor. And but also it maybe created the seed in my life of what later became the creation of the, one of the most important health organizations in Palestine, which is Palestinian Medical Relief Society.
Dr. Mustafa, I just want to, because obviously our, a lot of our audience, for many of them, this will be new information. So, I mean, just to go back to, and just to remind our audience that from the time you were born until the 67 war, you were basically, I mean, the West Bank was part of Jordan, correct?
Yes, under Jordanian rule.
And so after 67, now that the Israelis have taken over, what was the change like in the streets? Was there a definite, could one sense, there's a new occupier coming, then how did that feel?
Of course, we were immediately put under curfew by Israeli army. And we became under military Israeli occupation. No rights, no civil rights, military rule. They could do anything to you. Many people were killed on these days without a reason. Many young people I knew or I heard about were also shot to death because the army decided to shoot them. There was immediately an economic collapse because the whole system collapsed. A certain number of people were forced out of Palestine, becoming refugees again in 1967. But then our whole life has changed. We became under military occupation. We did not go to school for 3 months because there was a strike against Israeli rule. But after that and since then, we lived under military occupation.
When in the immediate aftermath of this, this is as you becoming a man, really, moving from a boy to becoming a man. Did you fluctuate between hope and despair? And what was that like? Did you think in 67 or 3 months once you started school, 3 months after that, did you think that maybe freedom will come in the 70s or 80s? Or did you think it will even be sooner? What was your frame of mind, if you can go back to that period and think about what you and your society and your family, what were your hopes and expectations?
None of us thought it will be lasting for 57 years, this occupation. That's for sure. And many thought it's a matter of few years. But also many people thought the same way in 1948. And when they were expelled from Palestine through the act of ethnic cleansing by Israel. But I remember later in the 70s, maybe, when my father started to say, there will be liberation, but not in my life.
And so, how old were you when you first heard that?
When I heard that?
Yep.
Maybe by that time I was like 23, 24 after I came back from university.
And so until you were 23 or 24, you had not really, I mean, I think what you're trying to say is you had not really internalized that the freedom will only come after his lifetime. Never mind. And now you are already you're almost in your 70s as well.
Exactly.
You then went to study medicine in Russia.
Right.
Try to tell us how difficult was it for you to get the papers and to go and study medicine in Russia. And why Russia? Were you not allowed to study medicine in Palestine? What was the thinking there?
It's not that we were not allowed to study medicine in Palestine. We did not have any medical school in Palestine. So people had to go outside, either to Egypt or to Lebanon or to Russia. And my marks were quite good in that school. And I got a scholarship to Russia, to Moscow, which I liked very much. And I went to study there, and was it difficult? I'll tell you what was difficult. What was difficult was that I was politically active before I went to study in Moscow, but of course secretly, and we were not allowed to publicly do political activities, but I was already by the age of 14, I was already enrolled in political activity, in student activities. And so when I was in Moscow, I was practically a student leader, you know. And
Should I lead a related to Palestinian solidarity and liberation? Or okay.
Of course, to Palestinian solidarity, Palestinian struggle. And that created a problem for me because by the second year, my name started to be known. And then the students who would come for holidays to Palestine, many of them would be stopped and interrogated by the Israeli military authorities. And many would be forbidden from going home, going back to their schools. So I know many students who were with me, even people who were studying medicine, who lost the opportunity because the Israelis would not allow them to leave again.
So they'd go back for vacation at the end of a year, or
and then they would be stuck.
And then they'd be stuck.
And then, so I decided not to come back.
So you stayed
my
in Moscow for 7 years without, it was 7 years or
without
8 years?
Without coming any, yeah, at all. And I would spend the, while summer holidays for others was holidays, for me it was work, because I would be working with new students and preparing to receive new students and helping them.
And am I correct to assume there was quite a large Palestinian contingent of students studying medicine in Moscow?
Not only medicine, all kinds of studies.
All kinds of things, yes.
And we had Palestinian students in 18 different cities in the Soviet Union.
You mentioned that
we had students in other countries like Germany, Bulgaria, other places.
And I'm guessing this is because there weren't many, many universities and colleges for you to actually pursue further education.
Because we didn't have really universities. I mean, except one college, which was Birzeit College, and later other universities started to appear. But and now we have maybe four or five medical schools, but then back then we didn't have any. Referring to give you an idea about the life of a Palestinian, in 1976, my mother, who was a bit sick, she had diabetes and other things, could not tolerate not seeing me for six years, you know. And so we decided we would meet in Syria. So my father and my mother and two of my sisters would travel to Damascus, and I will come from Moscow to Damascus, and we would meet there for 6 days. That brought to my mind another experience with my uncle, who after being in prison and so on, went to Kuwait and could not come back because he was afraid he would be arrested again in the 60s, I'm talking. So he decided to come to Damascus to meet my father and my aunt. And my father took me with him when I was 6 years old. You know. So it's like history repeats itself, you know, for Palestinians. That experience is a small thing, but the fact that we live under occupation, the fact that we are killed by occupiers, the fact that we have been bombarded so many times, the fact that we are sent to prison, it's a repeated experience for every Palestinian family, whether you live in West Bank or Gaza or inside 1948 areas.
When you came back from Moscow after 7 years of becoming a doctor, and you returned back home, were things the same? Were things different? How did you experience that?
Oh, they were worse actually, because the West Bank started in 1974 to see different small uprisings against occupation, and the oppression of the occupiers became worse. And by that time, Israel had consolidated hundreds of new laws, military laws that allows them to confiscate land and to control the life of the people. And so it was becoming worse, and the Palestinian resistance was growing as well. And so I think that these were the years of transformation for the Palestinian National Movement. From one side, there is a growth of militancy and growth of insistence to struggle to free ourselves from occupation, and very powerful sense of self-reliance and self-organization. The same feeling I told you about that I felt in 1967, it became universal, it became national, that we have to depend on ourselves and we have to organize and to struggle for our rights and defy the Israeli occupation rules and so on. So it was, of course, changing. And But still, at that time, you could struggle, but you had to be discreet completely, and because again, there is no way of like being politically active in an open manner. And I started to notice how much people suffered, not only from the direct effect of military occupation, but also from the fact that Israeli occupation was depriving us from everything. As an occupying power, they had the responsibility of taking care, for instance, of people's health care or of other civil things, but they didn't care. I remember at that time, Israel was spending something like $600, $700 per capita per year on Israelis for healthcare. And in the West Bank, they were spending on Gaza no more than $18 per capita.
Wow, that's almost 30 to 1, the ratio.
Yeah, so, and when I came back immediately, you know, just to remind you, I still had in my brain that experience of 1967 war when I was acting as a first aid provider. And I decided we should create something to help people and a new structure, an organization. And we started by creating voluntary health committees. I was working at Maqasid Hospital. And in 1979, we started organizing these groups. I started organizing them, going to remote areas. Why we did that? Because we noticed I was working in the best hospital in the country. And we had patients coming from different villages, and we would treat them in an excellent manner. And then they go home, and I noticed after 3 months, they come back with the same problem. And we started to understand that there was no health network. There were no primary health care facilities anywhere. And so we decided, why don't we take the matter in our hand? And something happened in that year, in 1979. Hebron was put under terrible military siege for 1 month. And we wanted to go to Hebron and help people by organizing a medical mobile clinic, sort of. We didn't have funding from anybody. We relied completely on our voluntary work. We collected medicines from pharmaceutical companies, and we used our own cars. And we went to Hebron, and the army did not let us in. So on our way back, we decided we will not go back just without doing anything. We'll go to the next spot, which is suffering a lot from occupation, and that was Deshe camp in Bethlehem. So we went to Deshe camp, and that was the birth moment of a new structure called Palestinian Medical Relief Committees at that time. And we were shocked, first of all, because of the amount of needs and amount of fantastic reception by the people in the camp. So we decided next Friday we'll do the same, and the Friday after, and the Friday after, and so on.
And it grew into something else.
And it became an organization gradually. It became a network. So it was a great movement to help people in the health field, but it was also, it has a patriotic element in it, which is that we should help people steadfast against the Israeli measures that try to make their life so impossible that they would leave.
Okay, Dr. Mustafa, when the first Intifada starts in 1987, try to place for me two things. Try to place for me where you were then in your journey, because you're always kind of involved in politics, even if it was underground. As a student, you were involved in your medical organization and getting that up the ground. So try to place for me by 87, where were you then in your political and sort of social welfare journey? And also, what do you feel was the feeling and emotions amongst the people at that time?
I was politically very active, but again, not very openly. And there was great experience at that time. We had series of different organizations, like the Palestinian National Front, which organized the struggle in the 70s. Then we had a fantastic experience when Shimon Peres tried to create an alternative leadership to the PLO, through organizing elections for municipalities for the first time. And He thought that he will that people who are collaborators would run and win, and then they could become a collaborating structure with the Israeli establishment.
What year was and this? What year was this?
That was 1976.
Okay.
And Shimon Peres and the Israeli establishment were shocked because the Palestinian National Movement defeated them, and more than 95% of the elected people were pro PLO and pro Palestinian national struggle. And so that first experience, by the way, that's exactly what Israel is trying to do now in Gaza, to create some kind of collaborative structure. They don't learn from their mistakes. But in 78, when I came back, we already had a new stage where Israel was trying to create the so-called village leagues to also collaborate with Israel. And at that time, also, there were lots of confrontations going on in South Lebanon. And it was a very heated moment. And again, the National Palestinian Movement defeated these village leagues and forced them to retreat. Some people were killed in the process by Israeli army and by these collaborators, but they were defeated. And the ground was getting prepared for what will become the Intifada. And from there on, I think from 1978 on, what we had is continuous confrontations with the army, especially by student movements, by young people, and so on. And when 87 came, I was very much politically active in organizing and so on. But also medical relief was thriving. And when the Intifada broke out, we were quite ready to help, and we conducted so many different programs to help. We could talk about them if you are interested. But the public and the people were ready. It was a fantastic popular mobilization, unprecedented up till now. Everybody got engaged. It was truly grassroots, truly nonviolent mainly, and truly mass and popular. Everybody got organized. I mean, you're talking about young people, old people, poor people, middle-class people. Everybody was organized in popular committees to defy occupation. It started, of course, on that day in December in Gaza, when the workers were, of course, in September, I think, when there was an accident, but it was like the strike that opened the whole Intifada everywhere, because the ground was ready. People were sick and tired of Israeli army oppression, sick and tired of the way their life was running, and sick and tired of Israeli settlements that were expanding everywhere. And so it became, this was a fantastic moment in Palestinian history. Everybody got engaged, men, women, children, everybody. And Israel responded by making mass arrests and mass oppression of people, of course. People had hope, huge hope, that this would lead really to the end of occupation.
Obviously, that hope maybe comes as a false hope with Oslo, but it also happens at an interesting time in the world, because the Cold War is coming to an end. It's about that period where South Africa, Nelson Mandela is released, and they have their freedom a few years after Oslo, and they're already on a path to freedom by the early 90s. So when Oslo came, before the actual accords were signed, what was the mood among leaders that you were obviously speaking to, Palestinian leaders, and you're already by then in those circles? What was the mood, and how did the way that Oslo actually went about, and the accords being signed, how did that change? Was there support? Was there a sense of, okay, we maybe need to sign this now, because this is what we have, this is on the table. If we walk away, you know, there may not be another opportunity. How was it received, both by leaders and by the population?
No, I think I would describe it in a completely different way. The Intifada changed the situation to the level that Israel was unable to control the situation anymore. And the cost of occupation was becoming very heavy for Israel. You see, till 1987, you could say that it was an occupation with low-cost occupation. With the Intifada, it became very high-cost occupation. The reputation of Israel was going down the drain. and the Israeli oppression was becoming was started to be recognized everywhere in the world, and the nature of the Intifada being mainly a nonviolent action was also making it very popular worldwide. Although Israel arrested more than 120,000 people, mainly young people, although they turned to the policy which Yitzhak Rabin at the time, who was the Israeli army minister then, started the policy of breaking bones. And I remember in particular a day in April 1988. You know, I don't want to deviate the discussion, but by that time we have started to organize mobile clinics everywhere, started training people in first aid. We didn't have a blood bank, so we created a virtual blood bank by going around and checking people's blood group and then putting everything on a computer, and every hospital could call us when they need blood. Israel did not allow us to have a blood bank, so we created a virtual one. People were injured everywhere. We had to create first aid teams, and we had to organize more mobile clinics, etc., etc. So I'm just trying to give you a sense of the organization, self-organization that was happening. And at the same time, this led to a situation where Israel realized they cannot solve this problem by just more oppression. The day I told you about was a day when we had a visiting group from the United States, Physicians for Human Rights. Three of them were Jewish people, by the way, on the left. But many of them did not believe that Israel could do such a thing. And on that day, I remember in April, we had 45 people who were arrested. The army forced them to put their hands on the wall, and then they broke their both wrists.
So they broke the wrists of 45
people. Break them by accident. It has to be a direct hit.
And this was all just done at the same time, simultaneously,
same
in one
day,
location.
45 people in Ramallah alone. It was shocking, of course, for everybody. But that same day, I want to give you a hint of how occupation works. That same day, we went to Hebron with the same group. And in Hebron Hospital, we found, which was a governmental hospital run by the administration was run by Israelis. We found a family of three people, a woman and two of her daughters, burned in an accident that led to them being burned. And the three of them were suffocating, and nobody was helping them. And the whole hospital did not have a blood pressure apparatus. And they needed to be transferred to an Israeli hospital, of course. But the Israeli hospitals were refusing to take them. And so this American team took them in their cars and went and had a fight with the people in Hadassah to admit them. But you could think of thousands of other Palestinians who were dying, and the Israelis would not provide any help to them. So going back to your question, I'm sorry I deviated.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
But the feeling was that this intifada will force Israel to end occupation. When Israel eventually and the United States had to turn to opening the door for negotiations, people thought negotiations will now lead to the end of occupation. And as you know, PLO had to form a delegation from the West Bank, from the occupied territories, headed by Haider al-Shafi, who was most respected. And negotiations started in Madrid conference and then in Washington. And I was part of that delegation. And we were insisting, all the Palestinians from occupied territories, that we should not move an inch before Israel accepts to stop and freeze all settlement activities. Why is that? Because we realized that Israel was, through settlement activities, would repeat what they did to Palestinian land in 1948. Settlements first, and then eviction of people. And so we had very clear mind about the Israeli strategy, and we had very clear mind about our own strategy, how it should be. Unfortunately, the negotiations were stuck, of course, and Israel was trying to procrastinate forever. And then the Israelis realized that they will get no concession from this delegation in Washington. And they turned to opening a secret channel, which is Oslo channel, with the PLO leadership. What was really painful then is that the PLO official leadership, which assigned the delegation from occupied territories to take this role, conducted secret negotiations with Israel from behind our backs without us knowing or even being consulted. And that led to so many mistakes made by that leadership, which did not really understand exactly what was happening on the ground. So when the agreement was signed and we read it, we were shocked.
And how did the people receive it? How did Palestinians receive it?
In the beginning, the majority of Palestinians welcomed it. They thought this will lead to really the end of occupation. They wouldn't sit down and read what was there. And we were opposing it, me, Haider Abdeshafi, Edward Said, many other leaders, thought it was a disaster. And we even had the guts to form a delegation, me and Haider Abdeshafi and the legal advisor to the official previous delegation, the lawyer Rajesh Hadi. We went even to Oslo and to Helsinki and to Stockholm to explain to them that this is a bad agreement. We had the guts to do that in January, 4 months after the agreement was signed. Of course, everybody looked at us as if we were crazy. And the majority of the public was taken by the fact that the PLO is coming back now to the Palestinian territories. And they saw all these people coming back carrying guns, which were allowed by Israel. So for a whole maybe year, there was this kind of false feeling of success. But many of the voices, like our voice, was also clear that this was a big mistake. It didn't take long time before people started to understand that we were right. And
how long did it take? By the mid 90s, what was the sense?
3 years.
Was anything that gave rise to that, or was it just continuous settlement building, continuous stalling by the Israelis?
Continuation of settlement building, and then the picture becoming, two things happened. The Israeli extremists aggravated the Israeli public against Yitzhak Rabin, and these extremists were led by nobody but Benjamin Netanyahu, who wrote a book in 1994 called A Place Under the Sun, criticizing Oslo and criticizing the agreement and defying the whole idea of a Palestinian state. And he aggravated the public against Yitzhak Rabin till Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995. And then Netanyahu came to power. He won elections.
When he came to power in 96, I mean, it's again another question. It's going back to that similar feeling. I'm not saying it's the same. It's a bit different, but to just immediately after the 1967 war. But again, this is now 4 years after Oslo. Did you then think that, you know, 28 years later, you'd still be further from liberation than ever? Potentially.
Because of Oslo agreement, yes.
Yeah, so in a way, you knew that under Oslo, there's just no way. As long as Oslo is in place, this peace process is in place.
It was false.
It was always a false hope.
Oslo was meant to, also I described it once as the most genius idea that Israel has brought to life. And especially this very cunning man, Shimon Peres, at the time. Because the goal of the Oslo agreement, as it turned out, was to deflate the results of the First Intifada, to change the new balance of power that was created, which made it impossible for Israel to continue occupation. So Oslo changed the balance power back into Israel's favor.
And then in 2001, you have the Second Intifada, which takes place. But also by now, Hamas is already in existence for 13 years, 14 years by the time the Second Intifada.
No, but there is a very important point, okay. 1996. It's very important because on that year, Netanyahu started building a tunnel below the Aqsa Mosque. And then we had demonstrations everywhere. And for the first time, in 1996, I was with the Palestinian demonstrators in the entrance of Ramallah. And I saw the Palestinian, some of the Palestinian people in the security apparatus, and some of them have been before fighters. They couldn't tolerate to see that the Israeli army was shooting people with gunshots and killing them. So some of them, without orders, without being instructed to, responded with guns. And then Netanyahu brought tanks and helicopters and started bombarding us.
And where was this? Where were the tanks and helicopters deployed?
This was in Ramallah and in other places in the West Bank. Netanyahu brought tanks and helicopters to attack Palestinians. And the second day I went again to try to help people. I was leading a first aid team. I was in my white coat. And while somebody was injured, I was trying to stop the bleeding on the fifth floor in a building. The Israeli sniper saw me and shot me twice.
And you were shot, where were you? Were you hit?
Yes, I still have 35 shrapnels from that incident.
So both bullets went into your shoulder?
Into my back and shoulder. And I had a small shrapnel here, or a couple of shrapnels here. But the idea was that if at that time even a doctor in his white coat would be shot and killed, and of course journalists were shot at and everybody, the whole atmosphere changed. And that was a turning point that led later to the Second Intifada. Because after 96, there was mediations and American medications, and then they went back to negotiations and so on. But in my opinion, on that day, in 1996, Oslo was finished.
So I mean, in a large way, the Second Intifada comes to almost undo. Undo may not be the right word, but to try to you know, get back that pressure on Israelis to end the occupation that Oslo has now sort of released from them. How do you feel about the Second Intifada compared to the First Intifada? The Second Intifada is a lot more violent. Militant groups have a much more larger role to play in the Second Intifada than popular uprisings. By then, how did you feel about the Palestinian liberation movement as a whole? And how did you feel, I mean, what's your thoughts about the Second Intifada?
In the Second Intifada, we had two different characters from the first one. First of all, it was less popular, less grassroots-based. That didn't mean that people did not participate in it, but it wasn't like the First Intifada where it was 100% popular and grassroots. So, because there is a second factor here, which was that there was a Palestinian Authority with Palestinian security structures, some of whom participated in the Intifada. And of course, the Second Intifada was quite different from the first one because it tend to be more militarized. So there was a difference. But again, in the Second Intifada, we thought maybe this time this will bring us to freedom and independence.
But did the Second Intifada ever bring that hope that you had from the First Intifada during it, while it was happening? Or was there already sort of a malaise that was growing over?
No, there was hope. Maybe not as strong as in the First Intifada, but there was hope. And there was understanding that Israel does not understand anything but the language of power.
Tell us about your opposition to the PA and Yasser Arafat.
Before the Second Intifada, we were in opposition. Me, Haider Abdeshafi, and many others. And what gathered us together was the opposition to Oslo. And not only to Oslo, but the way the Palestinian Authority was running its affairs in terms of poor governance, lack of democracy, etc. And we decided to form a new political movement. We realized that there was a huge, huge number of what we call silent majority in Palestine, people who wanted something that is not necessarily Fatah or Hamas, a middle ground. And that's when we decided to create a new political movement called the Palestinian National Initiative in 2002 during the Intifada. But during the Intifada, we became very close with Yasser Arafat because now we were in struggle together. And he then realized that I think in the second Intifada, he completely realized that Oslo was a mistake. And one day, it's important to mention that one day I was sitting with him alone. He, by that time, he appreciated very much what we were doing and so on, and inviting us to all leadership meetings, etc. And one day I was with him alone, and he was trying to sit in the sun because he was under siege. The Israelis besieged
what,
his.
What year was this, plus minus, if you can remember, when you were
2003.
Okay.
And he said to me, now he realized that Oslo was a trap. Oslo Agreement was a trap.
Arafat then passes on in late 2004.
President Arafat was killed, in my opinion. I think they assassinated him.
And then after he passes away, you run against Abbas in the 2005 presidential election.
As you said, in 2005, I ran against Abbas and I got 20% of the vote. I think a bit more, because they changed the law of the elections on the day of the election,
okay,
which is unusual. They forced the election commission to change the law and allow people to vote without being registered, which, of course, created a lot of questions. But it doesn't matter. It wouldn't have changed the result.
Yep.
But it would have changed the proportion.
And then in 2006, Hamas won the parliamentary elections.
And then we had Palestinian parliament election, and I participated with my party and won in the seats in the parliament. But Hamas, as you said, got majority. They got majority because of the mistakes of Fatah, but also because they have started to play a militant role. Before 1989, the original movement, which is Muslim Brothers, then did not participate much in the national struggle. But they were growing. And I think the fact that they had so many youth in this movement and the pressure from the national movement that why don't you participate in the national struggle, it created a change. And Hamas was born and became one of the most active national liberation movements. And when we had elections in 2006, our proposition and Hamas proposition and other parties' proposition to Fatah was that we should have fully proportional system, which means you get 10%, you get 10% of the votes, of the seats. And Fatah insisted that it should be half-half, half proportional and half regional by districts.
Okay.
Because of the mistake of some of their leaders who were thinking of their own personal interest rather than the general interest of the movement. And because of that, Hamas got 44% of the votes, but they got the majority of the seats. Because Fatah was competing also with itself, and because Fatah was carrying the burden now of the corruption in the Palestinian Authority.
How did the situation then go into a civil war, and what were the consequences of that?
When Hamas won elections in 2006, Abbas assigned them to form the government, as the law says. They formed a Hamas government, which was immediately besieged. And everybody boycotted, including all the international community. Israel was aggravating the whole world against it. Israel suspended the transfer of our tax revenue, because, as you know, the Palestinian Authority depends on taxes, but 70% of our tax revenue comes through Israel according to the horrible Oslo and Paris agreements. So Israel controls that. So they stopped transferring funds, and for a whole year, the government was not able to function properly. That's when I interfered, and as a political leader, and our movement interfered, trying to mediate between Hamas and Fatah. And I did mediation between the leadership of Hamas and Mr. Abbas from Fatah. And it was a very successful one. I'm talking about 2006 and 2007. It was so successful that in March 2007, we agreed to form a national unity government, which had Hamas, Fatah, us, and many others. Every party except one who won seats in the parliament was in the government. So it was very representative. And Hamas did not have majority in that government. And the program of that government was a program of two-state solution. Yet, although it was already a national unity government, and I was the only spokesperson of that government, still, and we had a very peaceful program, but the world continued to boycott us.
Boycott
And
the
Israel
government.
continued to boycott us,
And this
which
is because
led
and this is
to
because
the
Hamas was
collapse.
this is because
Yeah,
Hamas
after
were part of the
86 days, it led to the collapse of the National Unity Government, and that was the beginning of the internal split. And from 2006 up till now, Israel conducted 5 wars on Gaza, not one, not two, and each one was initiated by Israel, except the last one.
By October 6th, how did you feel, both you and I mean, from what you can gauge from the sentiment of Palestinians, about the prospects of a liberation or even of Palestinian dignity?
By that time, we had very serious difficulty, and we realized Israel does not want peace. That Oslo agreement failed. And the best proof of the failure of Oslo agreement the biggest mistake of Oslo agreement was that it was signed without insisting on complete and total freeze of settlement activities, as we demanded. In 1993, we had 121,000 settlers in the West Bank, which was a problem you could deal with. But by 6th of October last year, we had 750,000 settlers. And these settlers became a political power. And they produced fascism in the faces of people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who with Netanyahu created the most extreme government in the history of Israel. And a government that was declaring there's no place for a Palestinian state, there's no place. The reality on the 6th of October was the following. Israel is declaring there is no place for a compromise, no place for two-state solution. United States has proven along all these years that it cannot be a mediator because it is completely biased to Israel. The situation in Gaza, in the West Bank, was getting very bad because the Israeli army was killing people left and right. By the 6th of October, we had 240 people killed in that year, including 40 children. The settlers started to attack Palestinian communities, conducting settlers' terror, burning houses, burning communities, burning cars. And we had a serious expansion of settlement activities at an unprecedented level. And on top of that, two things happened. The Israelis started attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque in a vicious way, trying to change its nature as an Islamic holy site. But also they started attacking churches in Jerusalem. And the church leaders, whether Palestinian or non-Palestinians, were attacked by the same settlers. And then the turning point moment was the meeting of the General Assembly of the United Nations when Netanyahu stood in that meeting and declared that there is no more a Palestinian issue. He will liquidate it practically through normalization with Arab countries. The Abraham Accords, as you remember. And then he showed the map in the General Assembly of the United Nations, the map of the new Middle East for 50 years to come, showing the countries that he normalized with in green, or the countries he will normalize with, like Saudi Arabia, and then showing the map of Israel in blue, which included the annexation of all of the West Bank, the annexation of Gaza Strip, and the annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights. So that was the message to Palestinians. Your case is over. There will be no solution. We will never accept a compromise. We will continue settling in the West Bank till we annex it completely. And your future is that we will annex your land. That was the message that people had by the 6th of October.
Now, since the 7th of October, it's been almost 5 months, and it's been difficult possibly to even process what happened on that day, because ever since that day, Israel has unleashed a very brutal war on Palestinian people. But if we can just go back to October 7th, what are your thoughts on what happened on that day?
Of course, we were all surprised. Everybody was surprised, I think, including Hamas, because of the unbelievable failure of the Israeli army. As I was told, the Gaza Brigade, as they call it in Israeli army, is the second most powerful brigade in the whole Israeli army, and it fell apart in 3.5 hours. I think Hamas itself was surprised by the how things turned out, and then the borders became completely loose. And I think it was an amazing amazing indication of intelligence failure, of army military failure, of political failure. It was like Israel was sleeping in its dreams about the annexation of the occupied territories and the end of Palestinian cause. And that 7th of October woke everybody up. But of course, it led to disastrous also other events from what Israel decided to do.
What do you make of the present situation in Gaza?
The situation in Gaza is absolutely drastic. We are talking about, I've never heard of anything like that. We've never seen anything like that. You are talking about a tremendous humanitarian crisis that is caused by the three war crimes that Israel is committing in Gaza. In parallel, a war crime of genocide, a war crime of ethnic cleansing, and a war crime of collective punishment. It is very sad, and we feel very, very much affected by what's going on. Sometimes it's so painful, and you feel sometimes helpless because of what's going on, because the whole world is allowing Israel to commit all these crimes against the civilian population.
Okay,
you're talking about no less than 35,000 people killed so far, including those under the rubble, including more than 11,000 children. We're talking about almost 70,000 people injured, many of whom will also die because there is no treatment for them, and because Israel is also attacking hospitals, and because Israel is depriving people from medications and medical material. We're talking about not only people who are killed and injured, including women and children, but more than that, Israel has established such a horrible siege on Gaza, an unprecedented siege of Gaza, depriving people from everything, from food, from clean water. And this is leading to a horrible humanitarian disaster, especially in the north and the center of Gaza, where people remained in these areas and refused to be evicted, although many of them had to leave their places 5 or 6 times under the Israeli bombardment. And Israel is taking revenge from them by creating a horrible, horrible hunger. We have about 600,000 people starving now. People are searching for food anywhere. They've eaten animal food. They've been eating grass. We have, as I said, 600,000 people starving. 350,000 of them at least are children. And these people could die from starvation in front of the whole world, in front of the world where the United States of America insists not to pass a resolution about ceasefire. But it's not only that. I mean, since we are describing the situation, people are deprived of clean water. Israel destroyed all the infrastructure. They destroyed electrical system. They destroyed networks of electricity, water networks, sewage systems. And that's why you have also a horrible environmental disaster. And the result is diseases. We have 700, we have 30 medical teams working with us, with Palestinian Medical Relief Society in Gaza. And they report to us horrible scenes. We have about 700,000 people sick now in Gaza with diseases. Many of them are affected by the outbreak of infectious diseases. 10,000 approximately are suffering from hepatitis, infectious hepatitis. 70,000 are suffering from scabies, which is a skin disease that transmits from one person to another. More than 150,000 are suffering from respiratory infections. More than 140,000 from diarrhea, including 86,000 children, and so on and so forth. So Israel is trying to kill people, to conduct genocide with three methods: bombardment, starvation, and diseases.
Throughout your life, I mean, up until this most recent devastating war, did you ever think that you would see the scale of destruction that we have witnessed in the last 4.5 months?
No. What was shocking to me, two things were shocking to me. Are still shocking to me. First of all, I thought it will not be possible for Israel to conduct ethnic cleansing again, like they did in 1948.
Why did you think it would be impossible?
Because I believed in the international community. I believed in international law. I believed in the civilization of the 21st century. And the second thing that shocked me, I believed in what Western countries were telling us about human rights and international law and respect of international law, which we were advocating. And it turned out to be absolute, honestly speaking, absolute rubbish. What we've seen is that Israel is really intentionally want to conduct ethnic cleansing again at a scale that did not even happen in 1948 when Israel displaced 70% of the Palestinian people, conducting 52 massacres and erasing to the ground 520 communities. Now they repeat things even in a more vicious way. In this terrible attack on Gaza, not respecting any aspect of any human rights. And then the world community, and especially Western countries that kept educating us about the values of human rights and the international law and et cetera, it all turned out to be false.
Has Biden's response to all of this, has it surprised you or shocked you in any way, or is it just... What's your sentiment on that?
I was not surprised that the United States would be so biased to Israel. I was surprised about the fact that the United States became participant in war crimes, because the United States sent 2,000 of its troops to participate. They sent their planes, Britain did too. They sent their military advisors to help the Israeli army, and they organized the largest ever air bridge of bringing in ammunition and weapons to Israel, same weapons that killed so many Palestinians. But more than that, Mr. Biden did two horrible mistakes. First mistake, he repeated without checking all the lies that Netanyahu said, all the lies about decapitating the heads of children, burning children, raping women. All kinds of lies. The head of the United States did not respect his mission, did not respect the status of the president of the United States as a superpower, and started repeating whatever Netanyahu told him without checking it. Later, American media criticized that, and American media exposed that these were lies. But more than that, the fact that the American president and his Secretary of State and his defense minister, Secretary of Defense, and his National Security Counselor all participated in the meetings of the war room in Israel. That meant they carry also the responsibility of the so many atrocities that happened later. But the worst thing, of course, was the continuation of the American position of trying to stop to prevent and block any UN Security Council resolution to have ceasefire.
Do you think, I mean, it's almost a cynical viewpoint, but do you think it would make any difference who would be in the White House? Do you think Trump or Obama or anyone else would have handled this worse, differently in any way?
I think Obama would have been more respectful of his position.
More respectful, but more respectful, resulting in better consequences, or just more
respectful. I don't think
diplomatically.
I'm not sure. Of course, I don't know Obama personally, but my feeling is that Obama would not have gone that far and repeating the lies the way Biden did. And maybe he would have been probably more careful, but I don't think that neither Obama or Biden or anybody else would have changed the main thing, which is the American bias to Israel.
Okay, now let's talk a bit about the media. You've obviously been you've always appeared in the media quite a lot, and you've appeared in the media a lot since October 7th. There's two incidences. I mean, there's a few incidences that you've been appeared on. Mainly, you've been appearing on, and I think you've become even more famous because you've been appearing on Piers Morgan shows. Firstly, just what's your thoughts on there's two interviews I want to speak about specifically, but before we get there, just what's your thoughts on how you've been treated and respected and received by the media?
In an unfair manner by Western media.
Unfair in a surprising way? And if unfair, why is it unfair?
Unfair in terms of the amount of time that is given to us, the number of interviews we are granted, in comparison to what Israelis get. But the worst thing is that all these newsrooms adopted the Israeli narrative. And the anchors were told continuously by newsrooms to keep repeating the same questions and repeating the Israeli positions. I mean, it's okay, they can ask any question they want, it's not a problem. But usually, my experience in many cases, the question would be preceded by a whole monologue repeating Israeli position and then asking you the question, you know. That repeated with CNN, that repeated with BBC. There was no disrespect except for one case with this person, Julia Hartley, at Talk TV. But there was very clear bias all the time. There was respect, but there was bias. And frequently there was this bias reflected itself in a very immoral way. When, for instance, in one case, when I insisted on my point and pushed it, the BBC cut off the broadcast completely. That was one incident that showed you. I could feel that they do not tolerate when the Palestinian is capable of bringing in his view in a reasonable and convincing manner. If they were instructed by newsrooms that you cannot allow this to happen.
I mean, I wanna play for you the clip you mentioned. I don't think I need to play it for you because I'm sure you know what's going to happen, but we'll play it for our viewers as well. This is, I think you know what's going to happen next. If you can see this.
You're placing that in historical context. I understand that. Please don't say that again. We don't have time for it. You've made that point five times already.
I don't know what you have time for.
Oh, my
for.
God. For the love of God, let me finish a sentence, man. Maybe you're not used to women talking. I don't know. But I'd like to finish a sentence, sir. Anyway, so.
No, you're so, misleading the...
So when, I mean, after that interview, what do you feel when you go home? What do you feel like? Do you just feel like that was some more, you know, silly Western supremacy? Or take me through that. Like, what's your feelings after the interview when you go home and you process what just happened?
You know, honestly speaking, of course, he was totally disrespectful of me, disrespectful of Palestinian women, especially disrespectful of my wife, and I'll tell you why. And she was reflecting an Orientalist white supremacist view of Arabs, Palestinians, maybe Muslims. And it was racist, pure racist. That's how I felt. And arrogant and a bit hysterical. I mean, I could feel she was hysterical, actually. And as you noticed, I remained calm because I understood her strategy. I think her strategy was to provoke me. And you could understand why she was reacting in this manner if you look at the whole interview. Because the first 5 minutes, we had a very strong interaction in which I managed to bring in the Palestinian view. I think I felt that her newsroom people were probably... Or she had that in her mind. Now they will blame me for allowing him to say all these things. And so I think she was feeling very angry because she couldn't control the interview. Okay. But her behavior was totally unacceptable and unjustified. As I said before, I think she also showed that she was absolutely arrogant and unprepared, because had she done a little bit of research, she would have discovered two things. First of all, that I am one of the most prominent leaders struggling for women's rights and for absolute unconditional women's rights to be achieved. And I have a long life of participating in helping women organization and in empowering women in everything I did, whether in political life or medical work or anything else. But the second point, my wife is one of the most known women struggling for women's rights, and she is a well-known researcher. She's the most published researcher in Palestine. She is highly respected as a professor, as a teacher, and also as an advocate of women's and Palestinian rights. And she even got two honorary PhD degrees from two of the most famous British universities, King's College and London School of Economics. So how could I be a person who doesn't listen to women? You know, it was so stupid of her and so ignorant at the same time. And so, but I didn't think it was a big deal, you know. I didn't think it was a big deal. And then suddenly, 48 hours later, this went viral. And to my knowledge, there were like 1,800,000 complaints about this interview worldwide, from Mexico to Canada to Russia to all European countries. And but I think that what happened helped us, didn't but it helped show the Western media bias against Palestinians.
You mentioned you managed to keep your cool. There's an example of you not keeping your cool, if you can indulge me. I just want to again get your reaction to it's more Douglas Murray, I think, who really upsets
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly.
You shut up. You are not the one who is asking me the questions. You're not the anchor. So shut up, please. And let me answer. I am saying what you are trying to do here is to mislead the discussion. Ask. I am the main discussion here is.
Okay. So I mean, I think you know what happens there. There's a long exchange where you and Douglas Murray are speaking over each other and you tell him to shut up a few times. Have you told someone to shut up before an interview?
He was interrupting me.
You know, we can see that. But is that the first time you've told someone to shut up while being on TV?
That no, you can it happened also with the anchors of Arab TV stations when they try to not allow me to speak. But shut up is not like a very serious violation. You know?
No.
In another occasion, in a similar time with an anchor from Al Arabiya TV, which is an Arabic TV station. The anchor was repeating things that were not correct and also interrupting me. So I told him, please be silent so that I can answer him.
What's your, one of the other things we've seen because of the media and their reaction to this is and who they're platforming is we've seen some a very strange and almost gobsmackingly very racist, extremely racist views. And supremacies and camouflage supremacies and sometimes very overt supremacies. What's your response and take to that? I mean, you mentioned it earlier that when thinking about the U.S. and the international, the Western governments, especially their lack of being really forceful in speaking out against what's happening. But again, has this surprised you and shocked you in any way?
What shocked me was what I told you first, that all these people who are talking about human rights and international law allow now the death of international law and sending one message to the world that we are ruled now. If we look at what's happening in Gaza and West Bank, we are not ruled by international law, but by the law of jungle. And this is dangerous strategically because it sends the message all over the world that you can do whatever you want if you have the power. And there will be consequences to that. But if you speak about whether I am surprised from Western media bias, no, I'm not. I wasn't. Because I had had this experience for so many years before.
I think there has been, I mean, just from my own surprise, perhaps, is that often when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and the US and the UK in particular, a lot of credit is given to AIPAC and the fact that they're lobbying strongly. And so a lot of politicians or lobby groups or interest groups are beholden to the Israeli narrative. But now it just seems like there's, alongside all of that, there's just been this ugly racist intentions that's just been sort of bubbling under and almost seem to be unleashed because it seems like the type of arguments that are being put forth, and they're not always by people connected to interest groups. Often they are, but often it's just random people on Twitter or speakers who've really latched on to some sort of. I mean, what's your response to that? What's your response to this dormant racism? And why do you think that even after many years of education around racism, I mean, from 2016 to 2020, we saw the US was full of riots and protests against racism. And the world has become a lot more woke in the last 15 years about all kinds of human rights, not just basic human dignity. What's your response to that? And how do you think we got there?
Well, there are many, many issues here. First of all, part of the journalists in this world are biased to the Israeli point of view or are afraid of listening to the Palestinian point of view because they are subjected to what I call intellectual terror. One example, when it's almost close to McCarthyism, new McCarthyism. For example, the fact that they forced the dean of Harvard University and Pennsylvania University and MIT University to resign just because students were allowed to express their views, you know. It wasn't like these guys did anything or expressed a particular view. It's because they allowed freedom of expression in their campuses. So there is an act of intellectual terror that Israeli lobby is using. And it is McCarthyism that reached a level in Germany of arresting people who were just showing the Palestinian flag. Although Germany claims to be supportive of two-state solution, you know. But then the other thing you mentioned is this explosion of racism, of white supremacy racism. That is related to two factors, in my opinion. The first factor is that Netanyahu intentionally tried to mobilize every negative group in this world against Palestinians, including white supremacy, racism, fascism, look, he's building alliances with the most extreme, vicious right-wing people. And he noticed that there is a shift in the world to the right-wing, I mean, to the extremism. And he's using that. And he did it in the United States first by shifting the main alliance between Israel and American parties from Democrats to Republicans and to neocons in particular. But in addition to that, there was suddenly the Palestinian issue and what happened in Gaza suddenly brought to the surface something that was deep there. And that is these feelings of white supremacist discrimination and the anti-refugees feelings. And all of that suddenly came to the surface. Why is that? Not only because Israel was promoting that, and not only because Netanyahu lobbied these forces to be mobilized, but also I think because deep down, many of these people felt insulted, many of these right-wing extremists felt insulted that somehow these Palestinians, these Arabs, these Muslims, they look at us, regardless of the fact that we have many Christians among Palestinians, they look at us in this manner. How could they be so able to organize and use science and be capable of confronting the mighty Israeli power, which is our baby, you know? I think that is probably one of the explanations why you saw this terrible racism.
We spoke about what's happening in Gaza and what Israel has unleashed in terms of the destruction they've done, the amount of people killed, the amount of people sick, homeless, starving. What do you think happens now? I mean, 700,000, 70% of the homes in Gaza are not livable. There's a presumption sometimes within when people speak in the international community that maybe Gaza will be rebuilt, but it is a presumption. It's not a certainty. What do you think happens now?
Look, from the very first day of this war, I realized the real intention of Netanyahu and his government. Their goal is ethnic cleansing of Gaza and eviction of the people of Gaza to Sinai. And they said it. It wasn't like hidden agenda. Netanyahu said it. Richard Hecht, his military spokesperson, said it very clearly that every Gazan should be evicted to Sinai, to Egypt. And their whole approach to Gaza is to really evict people and annex Gaza to Israel. And there are strategic reasons for this plan. I mean, it's not all because of what happened on the 7th of October and that there were Israelis killed. No. It's more deep than that. It's the strategy of building this path for world commerce to come to replace the Chinese plan of this trade path that they are planning, creating a new path from India to Emirates to Arab countries to Israel. Also the dream of Netanyahu to take over the gas the gas field, which is very big, which is a gas field. And also because I think he has these dreams about creating an alternative to Suez Canal by creating Ben Gurion Canal between the Red Sea and the White Sea. These are all his plans, and all of them will not happen unless he takes over Gaza. So in my opinion, their main goal was to evict everybody out of Gaza and exit to Israel and then proceed with all these plans. They were shocked by the steadfastness of the people, by the strong position of Egypt, which I hope will continue, that refusing the ethnic cleansing, by the worry of Jordan that if ethnic cleansing starts in Gaza, it will happen also in the West Bank, and they will suffer in Jordan. So the main goal is this, and to achieve it, they were ready to do anything. All these massacres, 35,000 people killed, almost 70,000 people injured, 90% of the people evicted from their homes. Now 600,000 people starving. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable how the world could allow that. How the United States has the guts to go to the Security Council and prevent for the fourth time a resolution about ceasefire. The fact that they keep talking blah, 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 blah about human assistance, when Israel is allowing in 10 days, only 9 trucks in 10 days, less than a truck every day, when Gaza needs 1,000 trucks of food, medicines, water, etc. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable how the world could allow that. How the world allows Netanyahu to be so arrogant to say that Guterres must be forced to resign, to say that Mr. Lula, who is the president of Brazil, is a persona non grata, to say that WHO is an organization that supports Hamas, to accuse Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and every UN agencies, including UNRWA, that they want to destroy. It's unbelievable how this could be tolerated.
I mean, something has to give, because you mentioned that it's very clear, and I think it's clear to many people that Israel wants to ethnically cleanse Gaza, and they seem hell-bent on doing it. At the same time, unless Egypt does actually fold at some point, which I understand is really bad because it will enable ethnic cleansing, but the reality is the people of Gaza, the people stuck at Rafah, are now between a rock and a hard place where their daily life is really, really difficult. It's unimaginable. It's not
and
something.
And it will not be easy if they are evicted to Sinai.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They will be in another prison, a worse prison, maybe even.
But what eventually has to give? I mean, what there doesn't seem to be. Yes, international pressure is building slowly. The Americans are slowly starting to change their position, not their position, but they're starting to use a bit more, slightly stronger words. What happens? I mean, is this just a case of waiting for a year? Is it just a big stalemate between people in Gaza and their ability to resist and be resilient, and Netanyahu continuing? What's the end game?
I think what we need is to continue the pressure worldwide, and including here, to force Israel to have ceasefire. And to explain to the Israeli public that Netanyahu doesn't care even about the lives of the Israeli prisoners themselves. He's ready to kill them all. And Smotrich said it very clearly, that the lives of these prisoners is not important. What is important is to achieve Israel's goals. What you see now is fascism in the action. I think this Israeli government is a fascist one. And the fact that 99 members of the Israeli Knesset, which is 90% of all members of the Israeli parliament who are Jewish, voted with Netanyahu proposition to reject any possibility of a two-state solution is an indication by itself of how bad the situation is in Israel itself. We're not talking only, this is not an attack on Hamas. It's an attack on all Palestinian people. It's an attack on the right of the Palestinian people to exist as people. And that's why I think it's very alarming. And the only way we can stop that is through three things: the steadfastness of the Palestinian people, the resistance to this oppression, and a worldwide boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against this fascist regime, this apartheid regime.
Israel, I mean, they've made it very clear that Hamas should not stay in power and do not want to speak to them. They increasingly do not want to speak to the PA as well. Who now can speak for the Palestinians to the Israelis? Obviously, it depends on the Israelis, not on the Palestinians, because they're refusing to speak to anyone. But what's the likely scenario in terms of who will be an entity or people who can actually deal on behalf of the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, nobody can represent Palestinians but Palestinians. And what we need now very quickly is to have a national unity in structure internally to end this terrible dispute between Hamas and Fatah, to have a unified Palestinian leadership, and maybe create an interim Palestinian national unity government or national consensus government to confirm the unity between West Bank and Gaza, and to prevent Netanyahu from passing his plans, which is to keep occupation in Gaza and bring in some kind of structure of collaborators who would work under his authority. That's why we are negotiating now about how we can create a unified Palestinian leadership. And then it's not Israel who decides who should represent us. We decide who should represent us. And one of the biggest mistakes that were made by the Palestinian Authority was to bend under pressure and cancel elections in 2021. Had we had these elections, we would not have had this war. So I believe there are very clear three things. First of all, nobody can represent Palestinians but Palestinians. Second, a Palestinian leadership has to be democratically supported and eventually democratically elected. And third, if Israel doesn't want to talk to the legitimate representatives of Palestinians, we'll talk to other countries. It's not our problem, it's their problem. But at the end of the day, they have to decide. If they don't want two-state solution, then they have to understand that we will never give up on the idea of one democratic state with equal rights for everybody.
Final question, Dr. Burghouti. Thank you so much for your time. It's been quite a long interview. But just if we were sitting together, mortality aside, if we were sitting together in the year 2050, what would you want to hope that you're speaking about when speaking about Palestine?
2050?
Yeah, 2050.
I hope by that time, at that time, we would be speaking about how to develop the country and how to make it one of the avant-garde countries in the world in terms of science development and strong economy, prosperity for people, using this beautiful place for great kind of tourism. We are lucky God has been so generous with us. We have the place of the three religions here in Jerusalem, and this could be the most attractive place in the whole world and the most peaceful place in the whole world. I hope by that time we would be happy about the harmony that exists between everybody, regardless of their religion, their race, their age, their richness or poorness. I mean, a country of justice. And I believe in a country that would be completely free, where people have freedom of expression, freedom of organization, freedom of choice, but also a country where things are, where people have justice. I mean, no discrimination and no abuse or exploitation of people. You know what drove me into national Palestinian struggle was the aspiration for justice. And one time I was asked, if you were not a Palestinian, what would you be concerned with? I said, if I knew about the Palestinian issue, I would be working for Palestine as well, because it's the case of the case of a place where injustice is prevailing and where there is such an amount for justice. So I hope by 2050 we will be talking about how to make this place a place of justice
and prosperity. And just for clarity, when you say this place, you mean one unified country?
Yes, one country with equal rights for everybody. And I believe in that. I wrote an article in The Guardian last year on the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, where I said Israel killed the two-state solution. But the only solution is one democratic state for everybody. And Israel is having a third plan, which is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. I bet you, and I promise you and them, they will not succeed. We will stay. We will steadfast, we will struggle for our freedom, and we will be successful.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Mustafa Bruti.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not-so-unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfar Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.